China Clay. In 1952, when I was five, we moved from Birmingham to Plymouth because my father had got a job as a doctor there. The hospitals then had the evocative names of Greenbank and Freedom Fields, although the latter had been a Victorian workhouse and was built of grey granite. With Dartmoor on one side and Plymouth Sound on the other, there was another feature of the landscape I remember strongly from my childhood. The China clay pits and the way in which the River Plym could be stained a milky white by the kaolin. As I reached adolescence, the wider and inner worlds of literature started to take hold of my time and imagination. Although I also read much prose, I was increasingly drawn to poetry, with its unpredictable intensities and the special ways in which it seemed to require an imaginative act of making in the very reading of the words. From time to time, people have asked me who or what my influences were. They are inevitably so many and so various that it is difficult to say. Looking back later at the more literary ones, however, I wrote a short, somewhat wry and name-dropping poem some years ago, in which I tried to mention a few of the many poets who had helped to shape my mind and whose influence I imagined I had assimilated in some way. It was called China Clay and began, "I was a betchamaniac. I wore a larkin smile. My writing desk was ordinesque till Yeats became my style." I can remember the very room in which I first heard Betjeman's Slough and in Westminster Abbey. We read Larkin's An Arundel Tomb at school with Mr. Michael Meredith, another literary influence. And so I sought out Mr. Larkin's brilliant new book, The Whitsun Weddings, and even learnt and recited its title poem at the school's compulsory annual declamation competition. Auden's astonishing range and technical virtuosity impressed me from the outset when Mr. Way, or was it Mr. Evans, introduced us to Musée des Beaux-Arts and The Shield of Achilles. Mr. Meredith ambitiously initiated us with The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and I soon felt that aspects of my nervous, adolescent self-consciousness and acutely self-doubting timidities, social embarrassments, and suppressed desires had been pre-incarnated in this mysterious personage of the balding Prufrock, Help. And T.S. Eliot's baffling uncertainties led me towards Il Miglior Fabbro, his mentor, Ezra Pound, who appeared, or appears to me now, as a verbose, dogmatic, and lesser writer. It seemed impossible to write like Eliot, and undesirable to write like Pound, not that I needed to do either. Meanwhile, at home, there was much Dylan Thomas to read, including Under Milkwood, and I bought a Cadman long-playing record of the Welshman declaiming his greatest hits, such as Do Not Go Gentle and Fern Hill. One of my school friends had told me, after I had recited Binsey Poplar's, that I sounded like a frightened rabbit, and so, emulating Dylan Thomas's resoundingly actorish renditions helped me to overcome my muted and muttered inadequacies. At the same time, there was popular music and its simpler lyrics, Beatles, Stones, and above all for me then that astonishing wordsmith, the young Bob Dylan. I shall never forget in 1965, first listening alone in the house library during a study period, to the torrent of words and musical images on a borrowed vinyl copy of Bringing It All Back Home. My enemies of promise were Eliot and Pound. Both Dylans, Bob and Thomas, beguiled me with their sound. Later there was a reaction followed by other counter-attractions. For dryness, I chose Empson, though later I accuse an overdose of Verbo juice from Heaney, Plath and Hughes. I did not immediately take to Heaney's Death of a Naturalist, which I initially found at the time too clotted, but I soon changed my mind as I did with the best of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. In due course, until his death in 2013, Seamus Heaney became the living poet whose work I most admired. For much of this time, first at school and then at university, I was studying the classics, namely Latin, Greek, and ancient history. Inevitably, it involved a great deal of literature and translation. While I am now a lapsed classicist, to use Michael Longley's potent phrase, I only changed to studying English literature after 5 intensive terms at Oxford of what they call literae humaniores, ending with classical moderations. Fortunately, one special subject was Catullus, but even he could be rendered dull by excessively Alexandrian, i.e. Oxonian, scholarship. I felt that Yeats had a point in his poem The Scholars. I should have changed to English long before. Meanwhile, my adolescent self had been absorbing and storing the potency of individual poems by individual poets. I relished the shorter poem of personal intensity, and I see that from Blackwell's in 1963, I bought the Sky Blue Heinemann Selected Poems by Emily Dickinson, which was edited by James Reeves. Nobody I knew, not even Mr. Meredith, who had taught in America, seemed to have heard of her, though they knew about Robert Frost, who died in that same year. I loved Frost's eloquently artful approachability in After Apple Picking and Birches, as introduced to us by Mr. Way, and so I bought the Penguin selection. Later, 1963 became Larkin's watershed year in Annus Mirabilis, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. I remember them both and the contraband copies of Lady Chatterley's Lover open at certain pages, but that is another story. Catechised by Mr. Fisher and duly confirmed by the bishop, I had been given The Imitation of Christ by my Catholic convert grandmother. But I soon had my doubts about religion, dogma, creeds, and gods generally. At my request, my mother bought me the chunky, nonsuch William Blake and Walt Whitman for Christmas. A latter-day Catullus, Miss Dickinson and Frost, a fake Blake and a mystic, I wrestled God and lost. As if a choice could influence derivatives of me, the young Matisse of Plymouth, where the river milks the sea. Ah, yes, well, there it is. All this time I had conceived a growing love of art and painting, which the words and languages sometimes seemed to crowd out. It had started with Van Gogh, Cézanne and the Impressionists, and gone on from there to Klee, Picasso, Munch and others. The oversized art books in Plymouth Municipal Public Library were an education in themselves. So I suppose I am an amalgam, like everyone else, culturally and genetically. Like china clay, we can be moulded into numerous shapes, and in the meantime, influences flow in and out from all directions, places and people. After university, I remember saying to my father, I would like to go to art school. He just shuddered and made a bleating noise. If anywhere, he wanted me to go to Harvard Business School. It never happened, anyway, but I still try to paint as well as write, while teaching English has provided me with a livelihood. Beyond all that are those much bigger and less hospitable spaces in time, as represented by such words as sea, ocean, sky, the universe, and eternity.